Who the bloody hell's that?
Morning, Ange.
Ah, Anthony. How are we?
I'm really well. How are you?
Come on in.
I will do, thank you.
Did that sound staged?
Just a little.
No,
it's
it'll fine. Be fine, yeah.
I'm going to embrace the whole lounge pant thing next time. I'm going to put my University of New Hampshire lounge pants on.
You should indeed.
You're listening to the Corona Diaries, a sometimes random and often irreverent attempt to understand the psyche of singer Steve Hogarth. Hello and welcome to chapter 17 of the Corona Diaries. Steve H is already trying to distract me by showing off his toothy gap. And we're very giggly this morning. I'm going to warn you from the outset, we're already a little bit giggly. I don't quite know why. I don't know what's got us to this place, but we've just arrived there, really.
Did I tell you I'd lost my tooth?
It's been mentioned.
Yeah, I've got it. I found it again.
You didn't tell me up until recently, though, that you don't wear pants.
Oh, I lost those years ago, darling.
You only have the one pair.
I lost them all en masse. I lost my knicker drawer. That's what did it.
Without prompting, I found out that Steve H goes commando and has done for a period of a decade or more.
Yeah. I marked the end of my last marriage by refusing to wear underwear ever again.
Okay.
I don't know why. Oh. It just seemed a some kind of, you know, what's the word? A watermark, not a watermark, a watershed.
Tide mark. That's a thought I'm not going to be able to remove.
Right.
See, most blokes go out and buy a motorbike.
This podcast turned really gross, isn't it? We're just talking about pulling your nasal hair out and skid marks and stuff. So
yeah, but nobody knows about the nasal hair because it's in the episode that's not gone out yet.
Oh, is it? Well, we've got to raise the bar, man. We've you know, people are going to think I don't know.
I think that's what they're coming back for. I think we've got a Benny Hill audience.
They're coming back for the filth.
Back for the film. Actually, talking about the confusion of episodes, so there was a couple of comments this week on amongst our Patreon collective about the fact that we put out a bonus piece of content that should have come after another bit but didn't, so it referenced something that hadn't happened, if that makes sense.
Oh, they don't know about our time machine, do they?
They don't know anything about our TARDIS. No. But that did prompt the fact that I was listening to chapter 15 this morning. You've been editing chapter 16. We're currently recording chapter 17. It's a bit of a mismatch, isn't it? It's easy to get lost.
I blame the DeLorean.
Yes. Back to the Future again. Did you watch episode 3?
No, not yet. Okay. We don't have time to watch movies. My girl and I, it's just, but all we have time to do is, well, this is going to sound rude, but it isn't. It's pathetic. All we have time to do is fall into bed. But that's mainly to go unconscious in moments. Have a very exciting rock and roll lifestyle these days.
And the 5 seconds, 10 seconds a day saved in not wearing underwear, you've not found a use for that time.
Well, that is quite handy for cleaning one of your teeth.
What, the one that's down by the side of your bed?
Taking it out the glass. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Right, so we need to clear up something. We were saying this morning before we start recording that there seems to be a huge gaping chasm between what
between
we say and
one
the truth.
Tooth and the other. Sorry, carry on, Ant.
No, I was just saying there's a gaping chasm between what we actually say on this thing and actually the truth.
Yes.
And that's become evident since we did that little episode about cover versions. Because I kind of cocked up in terms of, I thought the version of Fake Plastic Trees that was one of the four covers that I said had been commercially released and was a unique cover, actually was the live version from the Walls album, which we did actually talk about. And what that means is that I've now been told, well, I've definitely been told about one, that there's other live versions that became B-sides to singles. And the one that keeps getting mentioned is Toxic, the Britney Spears song. And I'd forgotten about that because apparently the band put out 427 different versions of Thank You Whoever You Are, and it was on one of those versions, and you were telling me why that was.
Yes, it was because we were desperate for some kind of chart position, I think, and so I have to confess somewhat ashamedly that you know, we decided with certain misgivings, we decided to put out Thank You in loads of formats. It's an old record company trick, really. You put a single out in several different formats with different bonus tracks on each of the different formats, which forces your fans to buy more than one copy. And of course, they're all chart eligible when they're bought in the shops. So you can, you know, it's a way of bumping up your chart position. And we were desperate for it. And it didn't do any good, which is a lesson to us all.
Well, I'm feeling it's my fault now because I didn't buy the version with Toxic on it.
Well, I'm at least my guilt is assuaged slightly by the fact that I didn't exploit you quite as badly as I otherwise might have.
Right. Okay. None taken. So that's fine.
What you paid for them.
Do you know what I think I actually pay for them?
You don't get a chart position off the back of shoplifting either. That's another thing in the small print, unfortunately. Otherwise, I'd be out there whipping them myself.
Right, okay. Remember that. Remember that for the future. Hence the reason why Marillion never charted in Rochdale. Right, so Toxic then. So Toxic, which is this thing that everybody seems to be talking about, was a cover that you did. It was Britney.
Yeah.
Was it a fan club? Was it a convention cover?
It was a convention thing. We did it at Port Zeeland and then the subsequent conventions after Port Zeeland. But it was conceived as part of, again, this could be wrong. This could be factually incorrect. But the way I remember it was, I can't remember if on one of the conventions we did a whole set of covers, I think. We did a whole load of covers evening, which we probably gave a very clever name to that Pete thought up, because Pete usually thinks up of the daft names and the puns. He's a natural... A natural leader writer, you know, you know all those crap headlines that the Sun goes with. Pete would be very good at that. So whenever we need a title, we usually ask Trousers and he comes up with something. But I digress. We had a covers evening and each member of the band picked two songs. You know, what would you like to cover? And I think Toxic was in amongst that, unless I'm completely wrong, and it was a separate convention and something we threw in. I can't remember. And it was Mike Hunter's suggestion when we were casting around for covers to do. He said, what about Toxic by Britney Spears? Because it's a great song. It's a really interesting song, the way it moves about chordally. And the punters will it'll cause a stir, because to cover Britney ain't exactly what you'd expect Marillion to do. And I was on Pointless. It's not gone out yet, but they recorded a Pointless Celebrities thing earlier this year, and the woman who wrote Toxic was on, and I gave her a little nudge and said, you know, you should go online and just stick Marillion Toxic and have a listen. Might give you a giggle. I can't remember her name. Kathy something. She's a sort of staff songwriter for people who can't write their own songs, he said, as though he knew how to write them himself. She'd written it, and I met her, which was quite interesting after all these years. So Mike thought it would be a good idea. So we all had to listen to it, And we put that kind of slightly, you know, the piano and voice thing on the front of it, the slightly ballady kind of, stuck that on the front and then went into a groove and then did it like a rock and roll band. So I think it worked quite well. I mean, it was nothing like the original, obviously, but it was quite good fun to do. And that's about all I know. I don't think I dressed up for it for whatever reason, which is not like me. I normally, at the drop of a hat, I would have had the blonde wig on. But
yeah.
Didn't. I dressed up for Money, Money, Money when we did the ABBA. We did an ABBA cover on that covers evening, and I did that in fishnets with a wig on and everything. And it was truly ugly, but memorable. Unfortunately, when I came on in drag, it phased the band so much they made an absolute pig's ear of the song, and it had to be very heavily edited and fixed by Mike afterwards to sound even like music. It was a complete disaster because they took one look at my fishnets and nobody could remember anything from that moment on. but I didn't dress up for Toxic. It seems to have gone down very well, and we often get mail about it, you know.
Yeah, seems to be the thing of folklore. And then the other one. So I need to thank Rhys Page and Darren Moore, who were both vocal about this subject.
I got an email from Rhys Page just this morning.
You?
Yeah, telling me what was Japanese for athlete's foot.
Did you really?
What a thing to wake up to. It made me laugh. I said, you know, I said, there was a coffee at the breakfast table opposite Lynetta. I said, you never guess what? The first thing I've read this morning is what's Japanese for athlete's foot. What a life.
Look at Reese go. Look at Reese go. Yeah, so Reese reminded me about Toxic.
Domo arigato, Reese.
And then I posed the question to Reese, could he think of the other tune that had been a live cover that had made it onto a commercial single release? Because I'm not counting the fan, sort of the Racket recordings and a lot of the live shows in this. I'm going for the straight things that were either an official album or an official single. And he didn't come back with an answer, but Darren very quickly came back with an answer. And that is the fact that Substitute by The Who was a B-side on Dryland, on one of the Dryland singles, which I remember as well. Dryland, multiple copies. So the same record trick to try and get Dryland into the charts. And that was recorded at the launch party for Holidays in Eden at the Borderline Club. And I know because I was there.
Were you there?
I was there.
God,
I still have the T-shirt. Literally still have, can't get in it, but I literally still have the T-shirt. I went down with a great friend of mine, Jenny, and we went down and we saw that. And you did half a dozen little acoustic songs. In the Borderline Club.
Yeah. I saw Gail Ann Dorsey, Bowie's bass player, do a little acoustic set in the Borderline Club. It was the last time I was there. I don't remember much about playing it myself. I remember something about piping. I think there's piping somewhere, like copper piping, somewhere near the stage, because I think I was clanking on it with a drumstick or something during soundcheck. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's a low ceiling, isn't it?
It's a really low ceiling, and that's it. It's a really low ceiling, and there's these thick sort of like water pipes that run across that, if you're a musician, are irresistible. You've got to go ting 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 on the pipes. The pipes are calling from glen to glen and over the mountainside.
So back to Substitute.
Oh yeah, well that was an irresistible song in the sense that I was and perhaps will ever be a substitute for another guy. So good sort of tongue in cheek lyric to cover and a great song, and you can't argue with the Who, can you? I mean, it's the Who. So whatever you're going to do, if it's the Who, it's going to be cool. Have you read Pete Townsend's autobiography?
I haven't read Pete Townsend.
That is an interesting read in the sense that about halfway through it you think, this boy's really not well at all. You know, he's His sanity is questionable, I reckon. But it also, what really comes out of that book is the pressure that he was under. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable because he wrote everything. And so as their success started to happen, you know, it really was a case of everybody going, well, where's the next album, Pete? And he had like 2 months to write it, you know, because in those days the release schedules were just crazy. They would expect an album every year, and you'd spend most of that year on the road. You know, so, and when the Who went on the road, they didn't just go on the road. They basically mashed the road up.
Yeah.
I mean, that was not a that was not a nice, easy, relaxed situation. There was Keith Moon dropping cherry bombs down all the toilets in the hotels, you know, and letting bombs off during the TV shows, and, you know, and then there was Roger beating people up every time he lost his rag, and everybody was off their tits on acid, you know, and didn't know what was going on, but were trying to play shows. So, wow, how the hell Pete ever managed to write anything in between tours is incredible, really. And he invented the sequencer. I mean, there was no, I mean, those, you know, I mean, he made that himself with a soldering iron. You know, he may have been windmilling his Les Paul, you know, live, but off stage he was sat cross-legged with the smell of solder in his nostrils, trying to invent electronic devices. I mean, what a guy! And Jim Marshall, there's a story also that Jim Marshall invented the 100 watt amplifier at Pete Townsend's request, because they used to do all these gigs in dodgy places in East London, and the local gangsters would sidle up to the stage and ask them to play really shit ballads so that they could dance on the floor with their girls, and you couldn't say no because they'd have your legs broken. So Pete came up with the idea that if he had a guitar amp that was so loud that he could genuinely justify not being able to hear the requests, he'd live longer. And so he asked Jim Marshall if he could make a 100-watt amplifier. I need something so loud I can't hear anything except the guitar. And this may not be true, but it's the legend. And Jim Marshall invented the amplifier for Pete Townsend. So there we are. I've got another Pete Townsend story, but I'll keep going. Did you know that? I mean, you may know this, that the name Led Zeppelin was the product of Keith Moon's mind, because Keith Moon left the Who after Roger Daltrey had punched him. And he left, and he formed a band called Led Zeppelin with Jimmy Page, the name was Keith Moon's idea, and then they were sued by the Who's management and forced to get back together again. So Moon was sued and forced to return to the Who by the Who's management and record label. And then, you know, Led Zeppelin managed to find an okay drummer called John Bonham instead. And the rest is history.
Wow.
There we go.
Wow. I genuinely didn't know that. I knew the Jim Marshall story. I'd heard the Jim Marshall story.
And I heard a story that Pete Townsend and John Entwistle went on tour as a two-piece during that period and were on tour in Scandinavia as a two-piece. When they got the letter from the lawyers saying they had to reform the Who. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard.
Right. Do we know what they went out as?
No.
Oh, that's a shame. Oh, wow.
Mm.
Wow. That's a lot of Who information there.
I saw them at Bellevue back in the 70s. Did you ever see them?
No, never saw them.
Just the most electrifying, terrifying band to see. The energy was just unreal. The only band I've ever seen who ran on stage at full pelt. Mm. I mean, they didn't walk on. They ran on. And Keith Moon was turning somersaults as they ran on. He was doing forward rolls across the stage and they ran straight across from stage left to stage right. And then they went over their own back line and you could see them running in the dark behind their back line. And they did three circuits of the stage, front and back, before Moon sat down and started drumming. And then they just joined in, by which time, if you're in the audience, you were just going, before they'd played a note. It was incredible. Really incredible. And Entwistle used to have these bottles on his mic stand and he had gin in one and tonic in the other and the cycling straws that came up either side of the mic. So he used to suck gin from one, tonic from the other, mix it in his mouth while he was playing the bass.
He suck on a lemon at the same time.
Now, why have I never done that?
Well, if you don't do it now,
I could have tequila in one and Red Bull in the other, couldn't I?
Oh, don't try any of this at home, kids. So, and of course, he's gone deaf, hasn't he? Now, pretty much, Townsend. It's hardly surprising, really.
He went deaf after Keith let off the bomb in what was that show? The big American TV show, the one that would make or break you.
The one the Beatles went on.
Yeah. What's his name? Anyway, that one.
I can see his face. I can see his face.
So there they were on TV, the make or break American television show, the thing that could make your career in America. And what does Keith Moon do? He blows up the drum kit during the filming, and apparently he got the amounts of explosive wrong, and it exploded so violently that Pete went deaf in one ear and was deaf ever since. So that wouldn't bother you much, would it? There would have been a lot of harmony on the tour bus the night after that, wouldn't there?
You're starting to sound very not rock and roll, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm very temperate by comparison. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially these days. My rock and roll moments have been and gone, and I don't want to talk about them.
No, and I don't think we should. I don't think we should. This is a family show. We should keep it that way. Keep it that way.
Sorry, what was the question? What were we talking about?
We were talking about Substitute, but I think we've kind of done that now. But yes, Substitute was the other one. So thanks to Rhys, thanks to Darren. We've kind of covered that topic now. What we might do is we might do an Odds and Sodcasts at some point about the wider covers thing, all the stuff that's been played at conventions, because there are quite a lot of them. If you look through, there are a lot. So we might cover that as a special. But the ones that I think that draws the line under the ones that kind of were on singles or were on albums proper. So we'll hopefully that one's now put to bed.
Yeah.
The only other thing we had hanging over from last week that you said to me you must ask me was, because we were talking about Phil Brown last week, your front of house engineer, the legend that is, though obviously we have to whisper now because he's a spy, isn't he?
He's a spy and he has the whiff of the caravan about him.
Whiff of the caravan, because I've forgotten about that. The whiff of the fairground about him. said H. So you said to me before we finished, because you'd gone to do some natural shows in South America. I'll carry on talking until you've caught back up.
No, I'm worried.
The star of the show's in hysterics as we speak. He's trying to center.
I'm holding it. I'm fine now.
South America. You'd gone to do some natural shows, South America, and you said to me, don't forget to ask me about the missing airline.
Yeah, my God.
The Phantom Airline.
Yeah, we were in Buenos Aires, as you are. You know, we'd flown into Sao Paulo. We'd done Sao Paulo. I think we'd done Rio, and there's an interesting story for a kickoff about checking in Rio, which I wanted to mention, because we got to Rio Airport to check in to go to Buenos Aires, just Phil and I, And he's there with his trusty pally case, this green case that he won't check in. And it was a really slow moving cube. God alone knows what the guy at the desk was doing. So we just stood in this queue. This was all pre-COVID, of course. We stood in this queue for what seemed like an age, and we finally got to the front. And the guy at the desk, we said, can we check in with the put the passports down and, weigh the suitcases, and then Phil's standing there with the pally case, and he points at the pally case and he says, you have to check that in. And Phil says, I'm not checking this in. This doesn't leave my side, I need it. We need it for our show, and I always travel with it. And he starts shaking his head. No, you've got to check it in. And Phil says, well, no, I'm not. And you always get these things, the same with the jewellery, you've got to take that off. No, I'm not. So it's always very interesting checking in or going through security with Phil. Anyway, this guy just said, excuse me a minute. And he left the desk. And he never came back. And we stood there, and we stood there, and we stood there. And after about 15 minutes, he's not coming back, is he? Where the fuck is he gone? So by this time, the suitcases had gone through. The passports were still behind the desk. And he'd gone. And a big queue was forming behind me and Phil. And we're just standing there and looking at the people behind us and shrugging our shoulders. We don't know where he's gone. And to my knowledge, he never came back. And in the end, I think he might have had the breakdown nervous and resigned from the airline. And so in the end, we joined the queue at the next desk along. We stood there for another half hour, and when we got to the front of that one, we had to say to the guy at that desk, we were halfway through doing it with the guy, and he just went. And we both just going, bah, he's just gone. And the guy behind us going, oh, okay, fine. Like it was the most normal thing in the world, because they're all Brazilian and they're all from Rio, and the people in Rio are like nowhere in the rest of Brazil. They're just groovier and more laid back and more relaxed and a bit more sexy. And they don't really get uptight about anything ever. And all you need to know about Rio is that in the rest of Brazil, football is called futebol. But in Rio, it's called futebol. And that's all you need to know.
I can just see Alan Hansen just, coming up with that and clearing up that little mystery for us.
So then we get to Buenos Aires, cut a long story, slightly shorter. And I think the tour was scheduled for whatever reason that we would stay overnight in a hotel in Buenos Aires and then leave at the crack of dawn the following morning for a show in a place called Mar del Plata in Argentina. So we were going to leave and fly to Mar del Plata, which was, a flyable distance away, not a drivable distance. So we get up the following morning and we go to the airport, Buenos Aires, and we're met by the promoter's representative, who's this little guy who doesn't seem to like us. Soon as he sets eyes on us, me and Phil are muttering to one another, oh, you haven't got a number of his charm school, have you? No, I'm not sure. Motto. Anyway, it wasn't very friendly and it had a bit of an attitude. But his job was to get us to Mar del Plata. And Mar del Plata is this kind of run-down seaside town. A bit like, I don't know. The Argentinian equivalent of Blackpool, only less so, hasn't got a tower or any illumination. And anyway, so we get to Buenos Aires Airport, at 8 a.m. feeling bleary-eyed and half asleep, and the guys not, the promoters, reps not really bothered. But we don't speak Spanish, so we're entirely reliant upon him to check us in. So he goes to the desk and we sort of stand around, me and Phil, watching him from afar. And all we can see across this hall is the girl behind the desk shaking her head. And I don't like the look of that, Phil. No, neither do I. And there's a lot of body language and shaking of heads. And eventually this guy comes back and explains to us that the tickets we've got for the plane to take us to Mar del Plata for the show that night basically are for an airline that doesn't exist. And we go, well, how is that possible? What do you mean it doesn't exist? Is it? It doesn't exist. So is it, but, you know, all of those things that Western Europeans say to South Americans when things don't make sense. But, and you go, doesn't exist. You go, well, right. Shit. What are we going to do? So he said, well, there is another flight on Argentinian Airlines, but it doesn't leave till 5 o'clock this evening. And we go, what? You know, that'll get us there. We won't be there before eight. We can't do a show if we don't even land. You know, so what are we going to do? So me and Phil sit down and we're sat at McDonald's drinking endless coffees in this airport whilst people scratch their heads. And I phone Lucy and I phone anyone I can think of to phone just to vent and shout and go, what are we going to do? And in the end, it was decided we should drive because it was the only option. So we sat there for another hour and a half till a man in a minivan arrived and a minibus. I'm being a bit hard. It was quite a nice van. It wasn't like a van. It was like a bus thing. So this guy arrives and Phil and I get in this bus and we drove to Mar del Plata, and it took all day. I think it was about a 5-6 hour drive. And out of the window, there was just nothing except what they call pampas, which is just grassland. Mm. And it's as flat as a billiard table. Mm. You can see for miles. And then about once every 45 minutes in the distance, you'd see a man on a horse. And that'd be it, you know. And we just sat there going, Christ, oh Christ, have another drink. And Phil, what was Phil? He'd got his iPad and he was trying to get me to watch movies. He said, "Have you seen that Bob Dylan film, Rolling Thunder Tour?" He said, "You got to watch that. You got to watch that." I said, "I don't want to watch it, Phil. I just want to read my book and be miserable." He said, "No, it's really good." Anyway, he hustled me into watching that. And it is a fantastic movie.
It is.
Have you seen it?
It's mad. Quite absolutely
something,
mad.
Isn't it? It tells you a lot. Tell me, Bob Dylan, what a character, man.
Yeah.
He's actually driving the bus, isn't he? That's what blew my mind, you know. And you see him on stage and he's got the black eyeliner on and the white paint, and he just looks like and the hat with the feather, and it looks like a complete insane case. And when he's not actually singing, he's just grimacing through his teeth at the crowd, isn't he?
He's the devil incarnate. He's the devil incarnate. He really is. It was just it's a wild.
There's the violinist, Netflix, the girl with the snake who plays the violin, and takes the snake in a box everywhere with her.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She's amazing as well. Yeah. And then they all get on a bus and Bob's driving. I just think, what a man. So maybe it was his way of making sure everybody was on the bus, because if he wasn't driving, somebody would have gone missing, you know, every night on that tour, wouldn't they? There'd have just been fewer and fewer people with each successive show. So it's like, we better be on a bus because Bob's driving and Bob's counting, and, you know, and they were all terrified of him as well, weren't they? Because he's got this presence off stage as well, and everyone's frightened of him.
Mm.
And they're just waiting for him to fire them.
And the rehearsals and everything just were weird.
just like, it'd be like a big room. He'd like walk into one corner and rehearse one song and then kind of wander somewhere else and just kick off for something else. And it was all a bit odd. Well, it was more than odd.
Well, folks, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen the Rolling Thunder tour movie, I think it's a Scorsese
review.
The Rolling Thunder review. I think it's on Netflix, is it?
It is. It's Martin Scorsese who did it.
Yeah, check it out. It's amazing.
It's wild.
There's that great moment where they're interviewing Mick Ronson, because that's the other thing. You go, what the hell's Mick Ronson doing in that band? It's like he's been beamed down from space, you know, in another time and space. That's Mick Ronson. He said, that can't be Mick Ronson. And then it is Mick Ronson. And at some point they interview him and they say, you know, you're enjoying the tour, Mick. And he goes, oh, yeah, it's great, yeah. And he said, you know, how are you getting on with Bob? What do you think of him? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, what do you mean? He says, he's never spoken to me. And that was about a month in.
There's also the bit at the beginning where Patti Smith's on that in that little folk club, and she starts going on with some kind of spiel, and I haven't got a clue what she was on.
Oh, that is, yeah, that is really interesting.
She was just,
yeah,
seriously unhinged.
No, she was on a. I think she was. She'd imbibed something, let's say.
Just a bit.
I reckon.
Just a bit. You're transfixed by it. It's almost like you're driving past a road accident, you can't help but look at it. You start watching this thing and you can't take your eyes off it.
Do you know, it struck me about that as well with Bob, but, and having watched that, I came away from that thinking, how can anyone be that lonely?
Hmm.
Because he's removed from all the people he's with, and he's with them for months and months and months. None of them know him. None of them can suss him out because he's not showing his true self to any of them.
No.
And if you don't show your true self to anyone around you, then you're lonely. And how can anyone endure being
that,
you know, self-isolated to that extent? What's the point of being alive if you're just this... But then I suppose that in turn is the lot of a leader, you know, no matter who they are, whether they're a general in a war or, you know, or the prime minister or the king or whatever they are, you know, you can only be a leader by being apart from everyone else. And that must be intensely lonely. And I think Bob's taken that kind of self-appointed role, isn't he? As this thing that sits above everybody and doesn't reveal himself to anyone.
Mm.
There's a beautiful bit of footage of him in that room. Looks like a room above a bar, and they're working up one of the songs on Hajira with Joni Mitchell, and Bob's strumming along, and you just go, "Wow, I had no idea," you know, that. Wow. And you see, you know, what's really apparent is just how completely in command of the situation Joni is and how basically they're all, even Bob is a little bit in awe of her, you know. That's something. So, that was what I was looking at while we're driving across the Pampas to Mar del Plata. And when we got to Mar del Plata, it was -4 degrees. And it had been 42 in Rio. It had been boiling hot. And we'd flown to Buenos Aires, and in Buenos Aires it was about 22. And then we drove to Mar del Plata. We got there, it was -4. I've never been so cold in my life because I was dressed for the summer. And none of the equipment that we were supposed to have it was there. They'd hired all the wrong stuff. And there wasn't even a picture of me or a mention of me outside the gig when we got there. And I think I played to about 45 people. So it was well worth it.
Yeah, and then turned around and went 5 hours back.
We did. The next morning, we stayed in this mad hotel as well, which I'm not sure I can even describe. But the hotel was mad, and it was run by a German woman who was behind the bar. It was like something out of a David Lynch movie, the hotel. And it was just a very surreal experience. So I did this gig that, you know, hardly anybody knew about. And I was so angry, you know, at the promoter. Because, you know, I mean, all right, you do put the name of the artist that's going to play there outside the gig, don't you? Hopefully, with the posters that he's been sent and all of that. And there was nothing. And I was well cross, and I was freezing cold, and I was worn out, and I was just thinking, what on earth are we doing here? But there we are. So that was my dub platter.
Well, we'll move quickly to diary, only because I've just glanced down and realised we've been talking for 45 minutes. So this is going to be the longest chapter in history. So let's. But I think we're going to end up coming back a little bit to that South American, that little bit period of time. So I'm sure we'll come back to that further down the line. So we're diary territory, and we're just into the new year.
Exactly. Yeah, we're in January.
1992. Yeah. So I'll let you kick in with that, and we'll have a chat.
Yes, it was a little bit of home time before being hauled away to America. Saturday, 4th of January. Hung around to show someone the house at 1 o'clock. Went to Windsor in the afternoon, bought teaspoons and a clock at Cayley's, the department store on the High Street. Sunday, 5th of January. Stuart and Jill, my sister, arrived at 11:30 with Holly and Amy, their kids. Stuart had made us a pine headboard for the bed, and they've come down the M1 with it on the roof rack. We had a pleasant day talking and later went out to the river to feed the ducks, which turned out to be geese and swans, all nearly as big as the girls. We got our shoes and the pram wheels muddy and then went for tea in Old MacDonald's again. They stayed till around 9. Afterwards, we put Hargreaves to bed and took the Christmas decorations down. Monday, 6th of January. Spent the day looking around Oxfordshire again. Had a look at the clock house in Brackley and drove to Upper Hayford, Middle Barton, Mixbury, Bicester, etc. Had lunch in the Crown Hotel, Brackley. Came home at tea time, clutching a sheaf of property details. I now seem to have caught a head cold, which is steadily worsening. I think I might have one now, actually. Tuesday, 7th of January. Woke up feeling victim to my cold, blocked nose, ears and general strangeness. Had a bath and went to Chelsea for a meeting with John Arneson to discuss the year ahead. The compilation album is going ahead and it looks like we're going to call it 6 of 1 and 6 of 2. The studio won't be up and running till the 20th. Mark and I are going to the USA to meet IRS and also maybe Canada and Mexico. That's happening fairly soon. Had lunch with Tony Smith and John Crawley at an Italian round the corner. Opened quite a lot of Christmas mail. Nice card from EMI Denmark and from Sylvia at Virgin Hamburg. We seem to be getting lots of mail. 3 letters from Russia in this week's pile. 1 from Australia, a good one from someone in the States. He enclosed an SAE and a note which simply said, "I'm obsessed. Please help." Came home at tea time. Took too many tablets and felt weird all evening. Went to bed early. Dizzy stayed up with Niall. Thank you, darling. Friday, 10th of January. Took the car in for a service. Spent the afternoon working upstairs. I'm trying to find keys and key changes for Sympathy, which we're hoping to record later in the month. Spoke to John Arneson, who says he's earmarked the first week of February for the trip to Mexico and America. Looks like it's just me and Mark. Sue had friends and friends' children over in the afternoon, so I barricaded myself in, unsuccessfully, upstairs. Saturday, 11th of January. Quiet day. Took Hargreaves with me to buy new tyres for the car. They put a jack under the car, Mummy. She only needs telling anything once. Came back and showed a couple round the house. They seemed very interested, but we've heard nothing. I later went into Windsor for a mooch around on my own. Didn't really see anything or anyone of interest. Bought a couple of U2 CDs, Rattle and Hum and Achtung Baby. Diz doesn't like U2, so I'll have to play them when she's out. Sunday, 12th of January. Angie Fountain popped over from Eton with friend Linda, who might buy our house. She says Malk Foster, the bass player from the Pretenders, sends his regards, and it looks like he might be doing the Elton John tour. Had lunch with the family at the Beehive. Came back and watched the footy. Sue's friend Julie had a baby around 4 o'clock. Her husband, Gary, who's just designed the new Genesis sleeve, phoned to let us know. Watched telly, got bored, stayed up past midnight with Niall. He's currently up till late, but too young to know where the party is. Tuesday, 14th of January. Daryl and Juliet came over in the evening for dinner. They bought Lauren, who is now toddling and has become a right character. I thought she was a sweetie. A pleasant evening was had by all. Stayed up till 1 o'clock with Niall. Sigh. Wednesday, 15th of January. Up at 8:45 with Hargreaves, who's a little tired after staying up late last night. Popped out mid-morning for French bread and tarama salata. Ian phoned, so invited him round to hear my sympathy efforts. Hilda came for lunch with sons Max and Jake, who looks like a Buddhist priest. Ian thought the sympathy idea sounded promising, so I called Mark, who came round at 6, to take a DAT copy to listen to. Phoned Brothers, and maybe we'll meet up tomorrow. Jill phoned at 8 to say thanks for Amy's birthday present and told me it's Pete's birthday. Apparently Simon Bates played Incommunicado and mentioned it on the birthday file. I thought I'd better phone Pete and check that he knew. That it was his birthday, I mean. And he said he did, although he hadn't heard about the radio mention. Monday, 10th of February. Day one at Metropolis with Chris Kimsey. Spent most of the day setting up, and we managed to get a good take of sympathy before bedtime. The drums sound great. I'm enjoying working with Chris. Tuesday, 11th of February. Overdubbing on sympathy. Dined out in the evening in St. Martin's Lane. Wednesday, 12th of February. Started the day with a lead vocal on sympathy, did a few takes, and made a comp for Chris to live with. Put it to bed and started work on I Will Walk on Water. Slow going. Didn't finish till 2. Drove home knackered. Thursday, 13th of February. Chris says he likes the sympathy vocal, fabby do. Spent more time arranging Walk on Water. All night recording, but managed a good take before dinner. Overdubbed bass and my keyboards. Chris says my lyrics are cool. That's not bad from a man who's worked with the Psychedelic Furs and the Rolling Stones. Cheered me up no end. Stayed over in Chiswick Hotel. Friday, 14th of February. Went to AMI and then to the Float Centre in St John's Wood near Abbey Road. It's a place where you can climb into a pod and float in or on a solution of heavily saline water. Supposed to be a relaxing trip. Someone had had the bright idea of interviewing people inside there, and I was invited. I chatted to journalist Matthew Wright, who chickened out of climbing in with me and talked to me from outside. It might have been an experience if not for the photographer generally getting in the way and holding things up. Don't know about the float tank thing. I felt peculiar for the rest of the day. Sunday, 16th of February. Went to Richmond for lunch with small people. Niall's crabby because he's got a cold. Thursday, 20th of February. Dizzy brought me into town and then went to Yorkshire with Niall and Sophie. Had a meeting with financial advisor Merv and pushed the button on the mortgage for the new house. Phew. Finished the lead vocal for I Will Walk on Water. Stayed up till 3 a.m. listening to the mix. Kimsey's working well. Friday, 21st of February. Up and over to Metropolis for breakfast. Borrowed Ian's car and went home in the afternoon to pack and get the cot down from the loft. Back to London to hear the mix. Sounds great. Trevor brought me home so that I could have an earlier night. Left Chris Kimsey and Spence doing a 12-inch mix. Went home, tidied up a bit, went to bed at 11-ish.
And we're back. And yes, a nice little bit of home time in that section. The bit that struck me, because you know the bit that I'll have gone to. I'll have gone to the bit with the saline pods, and the journalist, and that's the Matthew Wright, isn't it?
Yeah, that's Matthew Wright from who later had the TV show called The Right Stuff. I think he's now DJing on talk radio in London. Because Rothers and I went in plugging an album recently, and Matthew also tends occasionally to crop up comparing the Prog Awards as well. Right. But I met Matthew when he was very young. We were in Abbey Road doing something, and EMI phoned me up and said, "There's this place just down the road in St John's Wood, and it's." What do they call it? What did you call it?
It just said flotation. Floatation.
That was it. Flotation.
Flotation.
Tanks. And you. It's flotation tanks, and you go and you lie in this flotation. And I'd heard about it. I'd heard about these flotation tanks, and thought, oh, that's a bit odd. So I was up for experiencing it. It's supposed to be very relaxing, and all of that. And, you know, they play you some new age music and you lie in this saline solution floating in the dark. What's not to love? Except that they wanted me to be interviewed at the same time, which should have ruled out a bit of the relaxation, to be honest. And I thought, oh, am I going to be floating in a tank with, you know, somebody? That's going to be a bit surreal. Yeah, I'm up for that. So I went down the road and there was Matthew Wright. So I was introduced to Matthew Wright and I said, "Are you getting in then? Are we getting our kit off?" And he went, no, I don't think, no, if it's all right with you, I'll sit outside and interview you while you're floating. So he sat outside the pod while I was in the pod. I was a stark naked. I was either stark naked or I just got my underwear on, which I used to wear in those days because I haven't worn underwear now for about 12 years. So I'm
I can
there.
Already hear, I can hear the comments flooding into Patreon when that bit goes out.
Well, we don't have to put this out. I'm just telling you. So
I know. It's going in. I'll make it. I'll shoehorn it in somewhere.
We end up. So that's how I got to meet Matthew. But anyway, all these years later, we went in there. What were we plugging? We were plugging. Oh, it was funny as well. That was the orchestral album. We were plugging that. And we went to Talk Radio recently, me and Rothers. And he says, "So tell me about this new album, you know." And as he said, "Tell me about the new album," his notes disappeared off the screen. He said, "Oh, my notes have disappeared off the screen. What's the name of the album?" And me and Rothers went, "Oh, fucked if I know. Do you know what it's called, Steve?" And he started laughing. He said, "In all the years I've been in media," he said, "you're the first artist that's come to plug a record that you didn't know the name of." And neither of us knew. And Rothers is going, "Is it called something to do with an orchestra, isn't it?" And I'm going, "I don't know." we were there to promote this album, you know. So then from time to time, I've bumped into Matthew Wright in various sort of do's and interviews and whatnot. And we always have a little giggle about him interviewing me in the pod when he was, you know, just out of journalist college or whatever he was just out of. And I was just out of underwear. I can't remember much about the interview. I do remember thinking that the flotation tank wasn't in any way relaxing at all, and you might as well just go and lie on a gravestone. It's a similar sort of feeling, really. There's nothing pleasant or warm and relaxing about it, or I didn't think so. Maybe they hadn't heated my water up and it was supposed to be warm and mine wasn't. I don't know what the story was. Maybe MI had done a deal, you know, and can our artist use it for free? You don't have to put the heat on. Kind of thing they'd have done.
I've got to ask, and I know that we're running a lot on time, but I've got to ask, because you just said, you know, that sensation like when you lie on a gravestone, and I'm thinking to myself, well, no, actually, I don't. So do you make a habit of lying on gravestones?
Well, you know, we've all been young once.
Yeah. Never found myself thinking, oh, there's a gravestone. I'll just have 40 winks.
I was constantly trying to get my girlfriend to have romantic moments with me, you know, when I was young, on wet grass or gravestones, you know, and then being slightly upset that she wasn't bothered.
But it turned out she was balanced.
It must be me, I used to think. If she really loved me, she'd definitely be up for this.
Right.
I've learned a lot about girls since then.
I think she made the right call. I think we need to leave it there because it's getting a little surreal.
Oh, a gravestone. How romantic. Yeah.
There's a TV show that Jack, my youngest, watches called The Loud House. And the premise is there's one boy and a dozen sisters that live in this house. Right. And one of the sisters has got that goth set up about her, and she's exactly that. She thinks there's something romantic about a nice coffin. And I'm seeing you in the set. You and
no,
Lucy Loud.
No. I'm not. I was never really sort of, you know, into any of that. You know, I'm perfectly happy for people to be into that, and I'm perfectly happy to go and have a drink with them as well. But I was never really into the whole sort of horror show, goth, get a bone through your nose and, you know, go and lie in a coffin thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's still time.
There's plenty of time. There'll be people climbing into coffins having listened to this, you know, literally in the moment.
I did a lot of things late in life, so, you know, maybe there is still. I could become a kind of goth in my 70s. Mm.
They used to appear in Leeds when the Sisters of Mercy would play, and Leeds would be riddled with goths for an evening, and then they'd all go. I always wonder where they went, because you didn't see them through the day.
No, well, probably very dark places, underground. Mm. Or maybe they just work in banks, you know.
I think they take all the gear off, get a
sensible suit on them.
And back down to the Bradford and Bingley.
Yeah.
Right. On that note, I guess that's it for chapter 17. So something particularly funny about the Bradford and Bingley. H has now lost it again.
I just got a vision of a goth sitting behind a desk in the Bradford and Bingley. That's tickled me.
Right, so chapter 17, and all done, and I guess we'll reconvene for chapter 18.
Right. Can't wait.
Can't wait. Won't wait. Take care, H.
Yes. Thanks, everybody, for being purple. And if you're driving home tonight, go to the Bradford and Bingley. Thank you, David Turetsky, and Carl Henriksen. Matthew Doy and Glenn Van Dyke and Linda Allen. Thank you, James Kirkland and Joanne Siney too. Laura Fairgreave. Linda Spencer, thank you, Keith Pavitt and Richard Einfield and Daniel Fry. Thanks, Brian Harrison and Stephen Brown. Thanks, John Lloyd and Mark Schindler and Simon Webster. Thank you, Dave Mitchell and Rob Fleming. Thank you, Dan Harrison and Marcus Waldman and Mark Wittenberg. Clive David Shackleton and Lynn Honess. Tony Maycock and Bonnie Boswell and someone simply called Petra. Hang on a minute, Petra Schulten. Thank you, SM Fargali and Bjorn Carlson and Darren Moore, Chris Lambertus and Sam Harvey and Jupp Veldkamp. Oh, Jupp Veldkamp. Hey, thank you, Jeff Conham. And thank you, Mark Hall. Sarah Teets and Craig Houston or Houston. Thank you, Steve Renner and Eve Duval, Chris Huntley. And Russ Parrott. And Scott Ashmore. I forgot Richard Kirkwood. And thank you, John Nine. Or John Neen. Or John Nane. Must be one of them. Ain't it great being purple?
Thanks for listening to the Corona Diaries. It featured Steve Hogarth with the insights and me, Ant Short, with the questions. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider subscribing and maybe leaving a review, as this will help others find it. You could even share with other like-minded souls, should the mood take you. This has been an A Short Stories production.